Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. From Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island to Errol Flynn's swashbuckling to Johnny Depp's Captain Jack Sparrow, our most enduring images of the classic pirate are rooted in one seven-year heyday 300 years ago, the brief golden age of the Caribbean pirate. They were brutal, says my guest today, and they were social revolutionaries, with Blackbeard at the front. This hour On Point, the brief and unforgettable golden age of the Caribbean pirate. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you felt the social revolt in the brigandry of the classic pirate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's little Errol Flynn from Captain Blood.
All right, my hearties, follow me!
Right behind that, from 1952's Blackbeard the Pirate, Robert Newton plays Blackbeard. Newton, earlier played Long John Silver, said to have shaped the way we think of how pirates speak.
Here's your scuttler, beyond a doubt. Truss him up for the cap first. Arr, then stripe him till he falls, and douse him with salt. Arr, and when he comes to, arr, and then let him have it again.
Later this hour, we'll hear from the ship's captain and diver who spends his days exploring the secrets of the pirates, including Blackbeard's grand ship, Queen Anne's Revenge. But first, joining me from Portland, Maine, is Colin Woodard, journalist and author, pirate historian. His latest piece in this month's Smithsonian magazine is headlined, The Last Days of Blackbeard. He is author of The Republic of Pirates and more, also state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press-Herald in Maine, where he won a George Polk Award last year for his investigative journalism. Colin Woodard, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So here you are. You're a man of parts, investigating, winning awards in active journalism there, and taking us into this history. We've all seen plenty of pirates on the screen. Many of us have read plenty, but I had never really focused on this seven-year period that you say is the seedbed for almost all of our images and ideas about the classic pirate. What created this little golden age?
Well, what's most remarkable is not only is it this one time period, it's one gang of pirates who all knew each other or had one degree of separation from one another before they went into piracy. They were former privateers and merchants, sailors and naval sailors. And this outbreak of piracy occurred not coincidentally at the end of a colonial war, now forgotten, called the War of the Spanish Succession. But the key thing is that at the end of that war, which was between England and Spain and France, the former British colony in the Bahamas had been sacked and destroyed by the enemy twice. And essentially, you know, it was a failed state. The people who were surviving were living out in shacks in the forest, yep. You know, hiding in case the next group of people came. And after the war, it's the pirates who moved in first. They're the ones who shored up the fort and created a base of operations from which they could not easily be kicked out, a sort of pirate republic, as it were. And this pirate republic was sitting right astride one of the major sea lanes of international commerce due to the wind directions of the age. Most ships had to go through the Florida Straits right by the Bahamas, which were this archipelago and maze of islands that the pirates mm-hmm. could spring out, sack ships and drag them back into this, you know, maze of uncharted reefs and the like. So it was an incredible combination of a location and an opportunity. And there were many, many people going into piracy because at the end of this war, the Royal Navy contracted by almost three quarters, dumped all of their sailors. There were many people who had been earning a living as privateers, which were people who were given permission by their government to attack enemy shipping in time of war, and many people were very good at it. It was essentially pirate skills, but suddenly at the end of the war, all their commissions and permission were revoked, and they had these skills and no way to earn a living. And so you had – and at the same time commerce went down, there were so many sailors choking the docks and ports of the empires, that merchants could pay them far less. So wages fell by almost half, and wages were already terrible. So there were a lot of push factors as well that were driving people into piracy.
So when we see that home base of pirates that often shows up, you know, whether it's in the movies or at Disney World, wherever, that's the model for that, I guess, is what? Nassau in the Bahamas in this 1713 to 1720 period, this failed state base.
Yeah, in reality, I mean, a lot of people associate Port Royal in Jamaica with piracy, but that's really a previous generation of buccaneers and people who were, in large part, were privateers themselves. They had had permission to go sack, you know, enemy forts and towns and vessels. This is the real pirate gang from which all of our pop imagery and the inspiration for, as you say, Robert Louis Stevenson and Disney come from. These were guys who had no permission to be doing what they were doing from anybody and were attacking vessels from all the different empires and doing so with some unusual motivations.
We'll look at those. I mean, maybe that's it right here. There were social and political motivations running through the just straight up brigandry.
Right. Unlike the pirates who'd come before, and remember, you know, pirates have been with us for thousands of years.
Of course.
And unlike the pirates who've come since, these particular pirates considered themselves to be up to more than simple banditry. Many of them cast themselves explicitly as Robin Hood's men, that they were leading a sort of social revolt against the powerful ship owners and aristocrats and ship captains who were making ordinary people's lives miserable. And this is also at a time in English and history in which the lot of the poor was getting far worse. This is the time period when many landed aristocrats were going through the process of getting rid of their serfs, of eliminating the long-term leases that had existed for generations, you know, the peasants, you know, having leases to their land and instead converting over to great big sheep fields to provide commercial scale wool to the new textile mills that were forming. And that meant that there were huge numbers of people with no form of work, you know, streaming into the cities, and life was getting more and more precarious for many people. So there were a lot of grievances out there, and the pirates were seizing upon some of them. And you can see it in what they did as soon as they would take over a ship. Remember, on a Royal Navy vessel or a merchant ship, you know, it was a rigid top-down hierarchy.
Yes.
Enforced by brutal discipline.
Obey or be whipped.
Exactly. And the pirates, they elected their captains by a majority show of hands. They could depose their captain at any time outside of combat in a similar way. They appointed another figure, the quartermaster, whose job was essentially to act sort of as a prime minister to the captain's president, to keep an eye on what the captain was doing on behalf of the crew. The captain on most vessels wasn't allowed to have his own cabin. He had to, you know, share it with many crew members. And most critically, they shared their plunder surprisingly evenly. On a privateering vessel, the captain might, you know, the owners of the vessel, the investors, would get half of the plunder you got. And then of the other half, the captain would get, say, 14 shares, and each ordinary crewman would get one. On a pirate vessel, of course, there were no investors to deal with because they'd stolen the vessel. But they would divide – maybe the captain might get 1.5 shares, and everyone else would get one. So it was a remarkably democratic, turning around and turning of the tables of the way things normally operated.
You quote one of this generation, Sam Bellamy, saying explicitly describing themselves as Robin Hood style, saying they, talking about the rich, they rob the poor under the cover of law, and we plunder the rich under the cover of our own courage.
Right, that's getting at the theme of what they projected their purpose was. And the interesting thing is that, you know, the authorities in the letters, if you go back into the archives of people like Cotton Mather in Massachusetts, or the governor of Virginia, Alexander Spotswood, or the attorney general of South Carolina, they're all writing back to their superiors back in London that these are the devils of the sea, the villains of all nations, the most terrible people imaginable. We must expunge them from the earth. But at the same time, in their letters, they're also complaining that ordinary people throughout their respective colonies are cheering for the pirates, are seeing them as heroes, are, you know, trading with them, or are rooting for them to win, all the way to the point that at one point in South Carolina, when they captured some of these pirates and were going to bring them to trial, there was a mass uprising of some sort that nearly deposed the government in an unsuccessful effort to release the pirates. So you can see that a lot of ordinary people were actually taking the pirate side of things.
Yes, in a movie theater they may get cheered, and they were actually being cheered at the time by their own contemporaries in many ways, but certainly not about all, and they could be and were brutal. They would it was take and plunder. And yet this piece coming in here as well, you say decades before Lexington and Yorktown and the democratic revolutions of the United States, France for that matter.
Yes, long before. I mean, that's one of the most interesting things is we rarely in history get to see what ordinary people were thinking because most of them were illiterate and not writing down what they had to say or what their thoughts were. So this is one of those rare glimpses, and you realize that large numbers of people were upset with the existing order, with this sort of tightening of aristocratic control and reduction of the options people had, and had sort of these radical, dangerous democratic ideas of rising up against that. So, and this is happening, 60 years before the American Revolution. So it's a window into how long those kind of things have been seething prior to when we sort of think of them as coming into fruition.
7 years when it was all happening in an unprecedented way, 7 years in which so many of the iconic images and ideas of pirates that we, most of us share, were established. Cullen Woodard, please stand by. A little Assassin's Creed black flag behind us here, Lowlands Away. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the golden age of pirates and the last days of Blackbeard. Here's a little sound from Pirates of the Caribbean. Prepare to board!
Hands, grapnels, and they're ready! Prepare to board!
The golden age of pirates when they were poor men's heroes in the Caribbean. Cullen Woodard is with us, author of The Republic of Pirates and the Smithsonian magazine piece, The Last Days of Blackbeard. Errol Flynn had some of that, we are the pirate people in his 1935 Captain Blood. Here he and a band of other outcasts come together to become dastardly pirates.
We are men without a country. Outlaws in our own land and homeless outcasts in any other. Desperate men, we go to seek a desperate fortune. Therefore, we do here and now band ourselves into a brotherhood of buccaneers to practice the trade of piracy on the high seas. We, the hunted, will now hunt.
Hey, desperate men, how dastardly we'll see. Cullen Woodard joins us from Portland, Maine. Introduce us to maybe the greatest of them all, Blackbeard. Edward, not Teach, you say, but Thatch. Who was he, Cullen? How did he come to be the great name among pirates?
Yeah, well, Blackbeard is probably the most famous of them all. And the reason is that while he was alive, I mean, he was a strategist and a thinking man's pirate. And one of the things he did is to consciously cultivate this image of – this terrifying image. He would put lighted fuses in his beard when going into combat, so his head would be, wrapped up in fire and smoke, and his men would all be carrying, a whole variety of weapons and grenades and boarding axes and braces of muskets and be wearing the finery of the gentlemen passengers whose ships they'd captured.
Yes.
And the crew of a ship that they were approaching to attack would take one look at them, and there'd be 200 of them on Blackbeard's ship, and there'd be 10 or 15 on this merchant vessel, and they wouldn't surrender without firing a shot, which is exactly what Blackbeard wanted, because they don't want to, Blackbeard does not, or none of the other pirates want to risk their own vessel being accidentally damaged.
They have no dry dock, you remind us, no place to take it to fix it if it is. So they'd rather just scare them to the wits out of them and take it.
The Royal Navy was having a hard enough time getting mainmasts, but imagine if you're a pirate, you'd never be able to obtain the parts. And then beyond that, they don't want to damage the vessel they're trying to capture, which may be valuable to them in and of itself or its cargo. And they also don't want to hurt any of the crew of the other vessel, because ask yourself, the number of pirates kept expanding during this time period very dramatically up until 1718. And most of the recruits were volunteers from the vessels that the pirates captured, because the crewmen on these vessels who were being underpaid and often cheated out of their wages and being fed terrible food and, you know, being beaten up by sadistic captains, they would look, take one look at these pirates dressed in their Mad Max style finery and you know, breaking open the Madeira and saying, hey, you know, that looks pretty good. I'm coming with you.
And it would look especially good if you were an African who may have been on a slaving ship. And many of those ended up on pirate ships as pirates.
That's one of the other remarkable things, is there were substantial numbers of people of African descent serving in the pirates' crews, apparently as equals. And some people of African descent actually rose up to be pirate captains themselves during this period. Now, it's intriguing, you know, because Blackbeard had at certain points a majority of his crew being of African descent and fighting alongside him, and some of the people he kept closest to him until the very end were African. However, he also, when he captured a slave ship, he sold many of the people he found below decks as cargo. So it's a perplexing thing what made the different pirates decide who was a fellow man and an equal aboard their ships and who was to be cargo remains one of the big mysteries. But it was in fact possible on many pirate ships for – and remember, this is at a time when they're operating in the Caribbean among all of these horrific West Indies slave plantations. And the word had gotten out about the possibility of a free life with the pirates to the point where many of the governors of some of these slave islands were writing back to the imperial authorities saying, you know, that there were rumors of the pirates were going to invade and that the slaves were going to rise up in support of their invasion. So there was a lot of hope out there, and that in and of itself was highly destabilizing to these imperial economies that were based at the time on slave-produced commodities.
Give us a sense of the scale of their plunder, their booty. It was enormous, you report.
Yeah, at times it could be quite enormous. I mean, many times you'd capture a vessel and it would be full of the usual cargoes, you know, of tar and cotton and lumber and such that was really hard for the pirates to fence. But at other times, they made some incredible captures. There are times when people were coming ashore having raided the sites of some Spanish wrecks off Florida and coming up with the amount of money, you know, that would have made them the richest people, and richest of all the aristocrats and the greatest dukes back in Britain. That's so it was a staggering amount of money.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And one of the tricks was, I mean, think about that pirate republic. You know, there wasn't much you could do with all that money or anything else if you didn't have somebody to sell it to or somebody who would sell you stuff. And because the pirates had set themselves up in Nassau, one of the key things they did is they organized a supply arrangement with the ethically flexible merchants of a nearby harbor island in the Bahamas. All these respectable merchants were transshipping anything they wanted. They were taking orders, going to the mainland ports of South Carolina or Boston or what have you, and bringing back the naval stores and the rum and whatever else the pirates needed, and buying their plunder that they had stolen from the what became an enormous graveyard of ships lining the shores of the harbor of Nassau. So it was, you know, it required that one of the reasons these pirates were so successful and got to the point where they were threatening the colonies themselves and interrupting the commerce of three empires simultaneously is because they were able to grow and have this support base, this failed state. You know, there are ways you can compare this to the Somali pirates who also have a failed state to operate in and sit next to a major sea lane today. That's what you need to really grow to be endangering the commerce of the world, is a base of operations that's secure. And the pirates had that.
How did this then Edward Thatcher, Blackbeard, emerge in this 7-year heyday?
Right. Well, he emerged fairly late. His career, he really starts becoming a menace in 1717, and he dies in late 1718. So it's a very brief period that he became famous and infamous. And he did so through a series of ever greater captures of vessels until the point where he was operating in a frigate-sized vessel, a vessel every bit as large as any that the Royal Navy had posted in the Americas to defend the empire. And this vessel had twice as many crewmen as any of the Royal Navy vessels, which meant in a boarding action, the Royal Navy ships would be doomed. So it had gotten to the point that the warships, the police as it were fleeing when they heard rumor that Blackbeard might be in the area. And as he, you know, cultivated this image of terror, stories about him got circulated far and wide very quickly. And what's made him famous ever since, and really many of these pirates and brought them to pop culture, is they were featured, well, some of them were still alive, in a book called The General History of the Pirates that was published in London in 1724 and is a fascinating mix of passages and descriptions of things these pirates did that are drawn word for word from official records and are absolutely true, and passages that we know are completely fabricated. And there are many other passages where we don't know if they're fabricated or not. But that book, with all its flaws, provided the received mythology of Blackbeard and all these pirates, made them famous even after their deaths, and was the source material for Robert Louis Stevenson and later Disney, and is why, you know, has conveyed that sort of the pirates as folk heroes onto us today.
Fascinating to imagine who might have written that, their political motivation. It was rather sympathetic toward the pirates. I was struck in all of your telling by how far north they're threat went. Philadelphia at one point worried about being sacked by Blackbeard and the pirates. Lots to look at here. Julia is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Julia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have just recently been exposed to this idea of the pirates being associated with a political movement through playing Assassin's Creed 4.
Okay.
But what
this is the video game with the pirate theme. Yeah, sure.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Also set among this very set of pirates in the Bahamas as well.
Yeah.
Right. But I keep wondering, playing the game and listening to your conversation, it's amazing to me that the unified political movement would have developed over such a short time, considering they didn't have instant communication at that time. And I wanted to ask about how fast did word get around among different pirates or the public, and how did communication affect, like, the development of the movement?
Absolutely. Did they consort with one another even, Colin? And I don't know, unified political movement, I don't know if you take it that far, though there certainly was strong political undertone here. But what about their interaction?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. Remember, this is at a time when communication moved at exactly the same speed as transportation. You know, for you to get word that something had happened, you had to wait for a ship to show up with some letters on board to tell you it had happened. And in all of North America in 1717 and 1718, there was only one weekly newspaper published in Boston, which, you know, to get around, which is just a couple of, you know, pages. So information took times to get places, but the remarkable thing is how well it did telegraph and travel. There were dispatches being sent around, and people would literally be correspondents, people who wrote the news of what was happening in a letter and sent it on to other people in other newspapers. And word did sort of telegraph from place to place with all the vessels that were moving around. Now, the pirates had an advantage in that they were all operating with Nassau as their shared sort of hub. I mean, they would operate as Tom mentioned, as far north actually as on to Boston and New England and Maine and Newfoundland and all the way south to the Spanish Main, to the coasts of what's now Venezuela and Colombia. And you'll notice that the Bahamas is right in the middle. You know, in the summer season they would go north, and in the winter season they would go south. And that hub where they would continually be passing through and dropping into, they could collect all the news from all the other pirates and pirate gangs who'd gone through and acted as their sort of central, you know, base of operations. They also were repeatedly needing to hide out. You know, the pirates would attack a bunch of vessels, or they would blockade a port, and they needed to go somewhere where they could hide while the authorities were looking around for them, and maybe repair their ships and get some rest and recuperation. So they had all these different layers and hideouts, and it's surprising in the accounts how often they would run into each other in some of these known, you know, hideaways and creeks and islands, and then be able to share information as well. So, yes, it was a problem in those days, but the pirates actually had probably better and faster communications than most others. And, you know, their political movement wasn't unified under a single individual. It was a sort of set of pirate commodores who had the greatest loyalty. And even at Nassau, there were competing factions. There was never any one leader, but competing groups loyal to one commodore or another all the time. So it was messier, sort of like Deadwood or something, where you have order from anarchy. But yes, they all seem to share a certain ethos, even if they didn't have a unified political structure.
But what a breakout sense of freedom and agency they must have had to suddenly be commanding their own ships and their own wealth in a time when that was very, very hard for common folks to do. Desiree's calling. Hi, Desiree, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Colin. My question is about the experience of women during this time with pirates. Were women ever on board as part of a crew? Were there any female pirate captains? Thank you.
Yes, an excellent question. In fact, this pantheon of pirates operating out of Nassau include two of the most famous women pirates of history, Mary Read and Anne Bonny, who both served alongside men and their crews dressed as men and did all of the fighting and cussing and everything else that the male pirates did. And this was, you know, considered a remarkable thing and was sensationalized in the general history of the pirates and in other accounts. But it is interesting, you know, we think of, you know, that generally women weren't supposed to be on ocean-going ships. It was considered bad luck and so on and so forth, which seems to have been largely true. But you also see that things were more complex than that. For instance, when Mary Read and Anne Bonny are finally brought to trial in Jamaica, having been captured in the midst of piracy, the first witness at the trial against them is a fisherwoman who was out in her boat and was captured by Mary Read and Anne Bonny and the other pirates. So we know that women were, you know, operating vessels on their own and doing those sorts of things at that time period. Exactly where the prohibitions began and how rigid they are isn't entirely clear. But yes, indeed, there were some women pirates, absolutely.
Gary in Charleston, South Carolina, pirate country, felt the sharp edge of the sword for a while there. Gary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Call, and I want to raise an issue because the pirates were actually very brutal and savage groups, worse than any of the drug cartels we read about now. I mean, this graveyard of ships that was mentioned a while ago meant the graveyard of thousands of people. The woman who just called in about women, most of the women on any of the ships that they captured would have been continually raped until they weren't usable and then just thrown overboard to drown. I mean, we're talking about absolutely brutal people. And yet we elevate them to be cult heroes somehow, make them Robin Hood characters when they were not at all Robin Hood-type characters.
And for a long time, our time is short before the break, Gary. I'm so glad you raised it just that way. I mean, for such a long time, we know that piracy meant murder and mayhem, and yet there's this celebration. What about those two facets, Colin?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the thing is that much of the mayhem and murder you hear about, the most shocking stuff, is not about this group of pirates. It's about the buccaneers and privateers who preceded them, people like Sir Henry Morgan, who'd think nothing of wiping out an entire, you know, Spanish city, women and children and all. These pirates, there are a few psychopaths among them, but by and large, most of what we know about them is from the accounts of their victims, and there are very few instances where they hurt or killed anybody. As I said with Blackbeard, with his effort to terrorize and not attack vessels, that was generally what most pirates tried to do to some degree, and they ended up killing very few people. The most interesting thing when you look into the pirate era is when you start reading about what normal established society was doing, you know, about orphan children in London being taken from the orphanages by chimney cleaners and forced to climb inside the chimneys to clean them out until they died from falling, and you know, other children for stealing loaves of bread being given capital punishment. And the more you start reading about the actual world that these pirates lived in, they start looking relatively benign by comparison.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the golden age of pirates, when they were poor man's heroes in the Caribbean in many ways, and the last days of Blackbeard in particular, with Colin Woodard, author of The Republic of Pirates. Not the worst of what we think of now as pirates. Privateers may have been much worse. He cites some of those here. On the other hand, when the chips were down, this was about plunder and robbing, no question about it. The legends just spin on and on from this, people's fantasies as well. Colin, here's a Neil listening and writing on Twitter, listening to Colin Woodward at On Point talking about pirates resisting the urge to drink rum and plunder something. All right, resist on, Neil. Here's the 2011 Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Fourth in that series, Johnny Depp's Captain Jack Sparrow meets with the crew of Blackbeard's famous ship taken, Queen Anne's Revenge, to devise a mutiny. But first, he has to understand his competition, Blackbeard.
Blackbeard. What are his habits?
Stays mostly to his cabin.
That's right, mostly to his cabin.
Yes, but when he comes out...
He don't really come out.
He must come out sometime. Any of you sailed with him before?
No, definitely not.
Any of you seen him before?
A bunch of wonderful murmuring, muttering nonsense in Pirates of the Caribbean. You say maybe he didn't even live in the cabin, maybe lived among the other sailors. Colin Woodard, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Jupiter, Florida, Captain Mike Daniel, ship's captain, maritime historian, underwater explorer, founder of the Maritime Research Institute, a nonprofit uncovering maritime artifacts. In 2008, he uncovered amazing documents revealing the last days of Blackbeard. In 1996, he discovered Blackbeard's flagship, Queen Anne's Revenge, off the coast of North Carolina. Captain Mike Daniel, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thank you for inviting me.
It's wonderful to have you. You're the only one of us who's been down, actually, in on the ship. As you were down there looking at Queen Anne's Revenge, what were you thinking about the life they lived, Captain Mike?
Well, of course, you know, a shipwreck's a capsule in time, and when you find it, you've got artifacts that tell a story in themselves. They help put the whole puzzle together, and you know that everything there came from that particular day in history. So it's really an important part of the whole puzzle. Of course, in unison with the documents, now you've really got what the kind of story that Colin can tell so well, you know, and that is to put all these pieces together and come up with, you know, the facts, the real story, as opposed to what we might find in the history of pirates.
There was something Colin's writing about you brought up that indicated maybe Blackbeard or somebody in that ship was wrestling with not just taking booty, but with syphilis.
Well, that is one of the pieces we found. Now, of course, that all ties back to Charleston. Realize Blackbeard blockaded Charleston, which is probably his most heinous crime. Imagine one group of maybe 400 pirates holding an entire city, the biggest city, by the way, in the entire southeast at the time, and holding it hostage for a full week, capturing the city leaders and demanding things, threatening to serve up their heads to the governor. That's the interesting thing about Blackbeard is, as Colin mentioned, he never really killed anyone that we have any documents. He never cut a finger off. Yet his threats were what made him unique. He threatened the most horrid tortures to his captives.
Colin, you say the same, that he was, in a way, a great dramatist.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, a showman, and was intentionally trying to scare everybody so that he'd never have to fight them. And it worked, you know, extraordinarily well. As Mike said, the he didn't kill anybody that we have any documentation of until his final battle to the death with the Royal Navy.
Mike Daniel, his greatest ship, Queen Anne's Revenge, what was the scale of it?
She was about a 300-ton ship. When he captured her, she had 560 slaves on board, plus a 70-man crew. So you can imagine just the size that it would take to carry that many people, plus the supplies to carry them across the Atlantic. So you've got all the food and water that would be required for that voyage. So she was large. She had 16 guns on board when he captured her, but he increased her armament up to 40 guns.
Your exploration is not only underwater down there on Queen Anne's Revenge off North Carolina, but also in very old archives, including in France. And no small part of what Cullen's writing about in the Smithsonian magazine comes from those documents about an encounter in the Atlantic. Where did you find the documents, Captain Mike Daniel? What did they reveal?
They were found in Nantes, France. It's an original account by the lieutenant on the ship, the Rose Emily. He captured two ships, and that's what makes, again, Blackbeard such a unique character. Instantaneous decision-making in order to deal with what was in his face at the time. He pulls up alongside the Rose Emily, threatens her, fires small arms at her.
And he's not in his big Queen Anne's Revenge at this point. He's in a very small craft himself.
Exactly. The vessel he's on is about a third the size of one of the ships that he captured.
Okay.
And less than half the size of the Rose Emily, which was 80, 90 tons. The other ship, which was called the Golden Fleece, was 120 tons. Blackbeard's in a 35-ton vessel and manages to capture both of them. But he comes up to Rose Emily and fires the small arms. The people on Rose Emily say, you better back off or we're going to fire on you. In an instant, he decides, well, wait a minute, let me see what else I can do here. He comes about, goes up to the Golden Fleece, captures her, and now he's got two ships. He goes back after Rose Emily, which is loaded with sugar, by the way, and captures her. The interesting thing about the Rose Emily is he keeps that ship. He puts everybody on board the Golden Fleece.
Mm-hmm.
He tells them, by the way, at the time, had you not had a second ship, we would have cast you into the sea or made you walk the plank, technically.
Okay, maybe that's theater, maybe that's not. Colin Woodard, it is plunder and robbery, but there's also a kind of poetry in motion in this fast thinking on his toes that goes on here, Colin.
Oh, yeah, it's very impressive. And he's always trying to find ways to trick his opponents and the like. There are times when he sneaks up to a vessel he wants to capture at anchor, you know, pretending to be another merchant captain. And then surprise, you know, come over for dinner. And when the guy comes over for dinner, he finds himself captured by pirates. So he was always doing things like that. He wasn't just, you know, and charging into battle. He was thinking about how he was going to get what he wanted with hopefully the least risk possible, even as the things he wanted were enormously risky things to try to get.
Mike Daniel is incredible to think of. In the 90s, finds this the great Blackbeard ship, Queen Anne's Revenge, off North Carolina. Take us to that last stretch of time of Blackbeard's, it was just one amazing year when he was at the height of his piracy, and it all ends up in the Carolinas. What happened, Colin?
Well, do you want Mike or myself?
Well, let's Colin jump in, and then Mike will take us to the ship itself, but lay out the broad stroke for us, Colin.
Sure. Well, he was heading up the coast. There was a pardon offered by the king. The King of England, concerned about how bad piracy had gotten, had pursued a divide-and-conquer strategy. Any pirate who would take a pardon from a royal governor would be absolved of all of their crimes and be able to keep their booty. So he was trying to divide up the pirates before confronting them. And Blackbeard was headed north towards North Carolina, where he would ultimately take a pardon from the governor there. And on the way, he sails into what's now Beaufort Inlet, and Queen Anne's Revenge, his enormous flagship, is run aground. And there's a debate as to whether or not it was done intentionally or an accident. But in the aftermath, he manages to get rid of a large number of his crewmen by abandoning them on a local sandbar and heading off to North Carolina with his most trusted corps and cohort. And he will go there. And North Carolina was an impoverished and struggling colony, and he basically is able to set himself up under the protection of the governor of North Carolina as sort of a Tony Soprano-like underworld figure, supposedly leading a legal life from, you know, viewed from a distance, but actually trying to engineer a new piracy operation with the protection of the authorities themselves. So he's involved in a big strategic decision when he loses the Queen Anne's Revenge.
No small number of African sailors under him there. We have a lot of listeners down in that territory. Maureen says, hoping that Ocracoke, North Carolina, gets some love on today's show. That comes into play here, Colin.
Yes, that's where he brings back the Rose Emily, the French vessel that Mike Daniel just described being captured. And he brings that back to Ocracoke Island, which is at the end of the Outer Banks. And he set up sort of a camp there where he can dismantle vessels they've captured and then transship their cargo up the creeks of North Carolina to what was effectively the capital then, this little village of 100 people called Bath, where all of his pirates were set up and where he'd married somebody. And he would sell those goods to the officials, the customs officials and others in the town. For the struggling colony of North Carolina, it was a source of revenue and potential wealth. And you also had all these pirates who were trained and in combat who would be around to defend the colony if they were attacked by Indians or anyone else. It had just been almost destroyed in an Indian war before Blackbeard showed up. So at Ocracoke, that is where he is when the Royal Navy catches up with him and he ends up having his final battle is anchored off Ocracoke Island in North Carolina.
Captain Mike Daniel, when you were down on the Queen Anne's Revenge underwater there, could you see evidence of the grounding?
Well, that was the main clue we used to actually find it, and that is, where was the bar? David Harriet, who was the captain of the Adventure, was one of the men that was marooned, as Colin had mentioned. And, of course, this is, again, a split-second decision on Blackbeard's part. He runs his ship aground. He's got some people on board who are after him and want to displace him and get another captain in there and take over. And so what he does is he takes that group and he maroons them, 25 of his own crew. That's pretty unheard of.
Yep.
For a captain to maroon his own men. But that was his situation. He had to do something with these guys. So bottom line was we were looking for the bar. David Harriet's deposition in the trials at Charleston states that the ship was lost on the bar trying to enter Topsail Inlet, which was the name of Beaufort at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And because the ship was so large, it couldn't cross over the shallow area. That's what the bar is. And so that was the main thing we were looking to do, was to establish where was the bar, the shallow area, at the time. Now, that changes because of geographical influences. At Beaufort Inlet, it would be the dredging of the inlet changed and reduced that sandbank by probably a third. And so the guys who had looked for 10 years before me, I went in and then took and drew a line a third further out, 30% larger area to look at. And it was on that arc out there a bit further out than anyone had looked before where the bar had originally been. We even found the buoy that originally marked the bar in the early 1900s.
Wow. Mike in Milton, Vermont. Thanks for calling. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Great show today. It's nice to hear about the Caribbean and the Bahamas and rum on a very snowy, stormy day.
Yes.
But wondering if pirates truly buried their treasure, buried their booty. I forget the name of the author or even the title of the book, but and it was fiction, but based the first chapter of this book was these pirates that went off the coast of Maine to an island and buried their treasure, set up this elaborate trap where half the island would implode and just false floors and just
right.
Very elaborate.
Oak Island, Nova Scotia, yes.
Okay, sounds Hollywood. How about it, Colin?
Well, if you think about it, why if you were a pirate and you had all this treasure, why would you go somewhere and dig a hole in it and stick it in the ground and go away? You know, what are the chances you're going to be able to return to that spot and why would you be doing that? What the pirates need to do with that is fence it and sell it for things they actually need or leave it with somebody they can trust. And in what documentary accounts exist of these pirates, there are no accounts of them going and digging holes and putting their treasure in it. There are accounts of them going to a trusted relative or to somebody well known to fence and keep treasure for people for generations. There's the Gardeners of Gardner Island, which was a manorial fief off the end of Long Island. It's still there and was in the family until very recently. For generations, they'd been being visited by pirates who had large numbers of large amounts of treasure on board, and when they left the island, they didn't seem to have the treasure anymore. So there seemed to be certain individuals that the pirates could trust, and I'm sure that the pirates, when they came to Nassau, had all sorts of mechanisms and commerce and supply chains and ways of selling and marketing their booty and
their
capture.
Booty. Colin, I need you to give us the 1-minute version of Blackbeard's last stand. How did it finally go down?
Well, the governor of Virginia is entirely upset that Blackbeard is operating with impunity in his adjacent colony, North Carolina, and he organizes an entirely illegal invasion of North Carolina, conspiring with the two Royal Navy captains who are based in Virginia. One group goes inland to Bath, and the other takes two boats down and discovers Blackbeard at Ocracoke. Blackbeard has been having a party the previous night. His crew is drunk and asleep, and they would have probably been captured at anchor, except the Royal Navy folks who are traveling in two small sloops ran aground on the way, and then there's a dramatic battle in which Blackbeard ultimately is killed in hand-to-hand combat, and his head is brought back, strapped to the bowsprit of one of these sloops and brought back as a prize to what's now Norfolk.
You may describe him as a poor man's hero, but clearly with his head on the bowsprit, he was not a hero to all.
No, absolutely not. He was greatly hated by the authorities throughout the British Empire and other empires.
And thus endeth the story of Blackbeard, but not really, because it just goes on and on and on in fiction. Mike Daniel, it must amaze you as a real historian of this, how in story and tale and tall tale, people just never tire of this, Mike.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when Blackbeard was killed, as you say, the story went on for years. There became this major conflict between the governor of North Carolina and Virginia. They fought for that sugar ship and the proceeds from that ship for years. Maynard, the guy who killed Blackbeard, was involved in legal suits between the captain of the ship that he was on. So it's amazing how deeply rooted and how important that sugar ship ends up being to the history of that entire coast.
Sugar ship, booty, the pirate Blackbeard, the golden age of Caribbean pirates. Captain Mike Daniel in Jupiter, Florida, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Colin Woodard, author of The Republic of Pirates, your terrific storyteller. Thanks for being here, Colin.
Thanks kindly for having us.
Arr, what a pleasure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
For when it's all over, a jolly sea rover drops in on his friend Davy Jones. Oh, his very good friend Davy Jones.